Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Intelligence Matters ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is Intelligence Matters with former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morell. Brought to you by Palantir Technologies, foundational software of tomorrow, delivered today.
As long as this current supreme leader is in power and Iran's endgame hasn't shifted, meaning they haven't made the decision to pursue the North Korea route and weaponize, they're still in pursuit of the Japan route, that it makes eminent sense for them to revive. So I would argue that it's more likely than not at some point the deal is revived, although I'm not arguing that it's imminent, and I think it will require a change of U.S. strategy or a change of U.S. tactics to get the deal revived.
Karim Sajapour is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he focuses on Iran and U.S. foreign policy toward the Middle East. Karim, who has been on our show before, was previously an analyst with the International Crisis Group based in Tehran and Washington. He joins us today to talk about a potential new nuclear deal with Iran. We'll be right back with that discussion after a word from our sponsor. I'm Michael Morell, and this is Intelligence Matters.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Karim, welcome back to our show. It's great to have you on Intelligence Matters again.
It's always great to be with you, Michael. Thank you.
So, Karim, let's jump right in here. In mid-August, it looked like we were close, perhaps very close, to a deal that would return the United States and Iran to the 2015 nuclear deal, the so-called JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. But at the last minute, the Iranians made additional demands, and it now looks like, you know, the talks are stalled yet again. I'm wondering why the back and forth with the Iranians. Why did they appear in August to accept the deal? Was that just the negotiators? You know, why did they flip-flop? You know, what's your sense of what's going on in Tehran as they think about the deal?
Michael, I'm always reminded of Warren Buffett's famous investment advice. He says, you know, be greedy when others are fearful and be fearful when others are greedy.
Wow.
And in the Iranian context, I often think, you know, be pessimistic when others are overly optimistic and be optimistic when others are overly pessimistic. The reason I say this is I think that when we in the West, the United States or European partners appear and we say publicly we think a deal is imminent, I think that the Iranians probably feel, okay, we can try to extract more concessions because they really badly want this deal. We can try to get some more in return, in exchange. And so on one hand, I think, you know, when we're overly optimistic, that kind of makes them get a little more greedy. At the same time, I think, you know, history has proven we have a 43-year case study of the Islamic Republic, and the instances in which they've compromised, you can really count them on one hand. It's when they've been under very significant duress and they feel that, you know, perhaps the window for a deal is closing. If they feel that the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, is in their back pocket and they can, it's on the table, they can get that whenever they want to, they have no fear that that opportunity is closing. I think that they have a sense of complacency, perhaps no sense of urgency, and they can continue to try to extract more concessions. So in many ways, Michael, I think that although this is a negotiation about a very, you know, large nuclear program, what is driving these negotiations, in my view, from certainly the Iranian end, it's not driven by economic imperatives. It's not really driven by even, you know, by defense imperatives. I think this negotiation is much better understood through the prism of psychology and politics.
So, Karim, I just want to pick up on two things you said. One is that, you know, they only make concessions when they're under duress. So they don't feel that they're under enough duress now.
In my view, there's a clear formula. When you look at the, as I said, the instances in which Iran is compromised over the last four decades, most recently being the nuclear deal of 2015, I think three boxes need to be checked. One, they need to be faced with significant multilateral pressure. So not just unilateral U.S. pressure, but, you know, they need to feel that they don't have an out card in Beijing and Moscow and Europe. Number two, it requires direct U.S. engagement, U.S. resolve. And number three, I think you have to articulate to Iran a concrete, limited endgame. What that means is that if you aspire for a maximalist endgame, you know, want to totally eliminate their nuclear program, you have 10 out of 10 goals, you're gonna get 0 out of 10. And so I would say right now, we have articulated to them that our end game is simply a revival of the nuclear deal, nothing more, nothing less. I think there has been direct U.S. engagement, although the Iranians have refused to meet directly with U.S. officials after the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, the supreme leader, outlawed direct contacts with the United States. And we essentially accepted that, which I'm not sure was the right approach. But I would argue that they don't feel a sense of economic urgency for various reasons. Number one, I think, you know, the sanctions against them are pretty onerous, but they haven't really been enforced. And that, you know, Iran's oil exports have gone up quite significantly. They're exporting a lot to China. And, you know, also the broader geopolitical context in 2022 is different than it was in 2015 when the JCPOA was signed. It is more difficult for the United States to work with China and Russia toward a common end. But I would argue that certainly it is in the interests of China and our European partners to have this deal revived. In the case of Russia, I think that they perhaps have different interests. I don't think it behooves Russia to see Iran emerge from economic isolation and start to compete with Russia in global oil and gas markets.
You know, Karim, you also said something really interesting when you said this is really not about the nuclear deal. This is about psychology. Does the psychology point go beyond just kind of a negotiating strategy? Is it deeper than that?
Yes, I definitely think that psychology and politics are important prisms through which to understand these negotiations. So in the political context, you're dealing with an Iranian government that is, you know, likely in the coming years going to be undergoing a leadership transition. The current supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, is 83 years old. He's one of the longest serving autocrats in the world. There's constant rumors about his poor health, including, you know, as we speak, there's rumors about it. I'm not arguing that he's on his deathbed, but I do think that, you know, the system in Iran is already kind of covertly anticipating what is going to be the impact of this transition. And you have powerful forces that Khamenei himself has appointed over the years, senior Revolutionary Guard commanders who believe that it's in their interests and the interests of these hardliners to preserve this atmosphere of hostility with the United States. They've benefited from, you know, security forces tend to benefit from an atmosphere of insecurity. And so they don't want to be entangled into diplomatic agreements with the West, with the United States. And so those forces have certainly played a role in trying to prevent these negotiations from succeeding, even though that's cost the country an enormous amount of money. According to even, you know, rough calculations, if you look at both the sunk costs of Iran's nuclear program and the lost economic opportunities in the form of sanctions, you know, even a conservative estimate is that it's cost the country over $200 billion, you know, for a nuclear program that provides less than 1% or around 1% of Iran's energy needs. So the politics of it is very important. It's a challenge for the United States to have a kind of a positive sum negotiation with an adversary that really has a zero-sum worldview. I think from the vantage point of the Iranian government, they at the moment believe that the Biden administration has telegraphed that they're totally committed to reviving this deal and that they haven't articulated any plan B. And so from, you know, the Iranian vantage point, they don't feel a sense of urgency to compromise, even though, as I said, this a lack of a deal, the sanctions which Iran is experiencing have caused the country, the people of Iran, you know, they've caused enormous hardship. They've cost the country an enormous amount of money. But the economic well-being of the people of Iran has never been, you know, the first or even secondary concern, driving force, decision-making factor of the Islamic Republic.
You know, Karim, you talked about the Supreme Leader and his age and rumors about his health. And, you know, it reminds me that ever since 2003, when Iran stepped back from an actual nuclear weapons program as opposed to an enrichment, uranium enrichment program, which we're talking about now, that he's been quite risk averse regarding actually building a weapon. And, you know, the assessment of all these analysts in the world is that they're not interested in getting a weapon. They're interested in getting to the threshold of a weapon. And I'm wondering, is there any debate on that in Iran? And what's the risk when he dies that Iranian policy with regard to an actual weapon could change?
You know, as you said, Mike, our friend CIA Director Bill Burns has said even somewhat recently that the CIA's assessment hasn't changed. They don't see any evidence that Iran is actually going to make a mad dash towards weaponizing their nuclear program. The model that, you know, it's often referred to, Iran's ambitions, is the Japan model, to have a nuclear weapons capability, to eventually kind of inch towards being a screwdriver turn away from having a nuclear weapon, but to not actually cross that threshold like North Korea and detonate a bomb. And, you know, at age 83, Ayatollah Khamenei is perhaps not going to change tack. You know, that's the strategy that he's employed over the last two decades. And, you know, perhaps he's unlikely to make a rash move. But as you said, there's no guarantees that the next Iranian leader is going to have the same calculations. And, you know, when you look at history over the last two decades, you could see how, you know, an Iranian military commander could make an argument that it perhaps behooves the regime to actually change strategies and start to weaponize their program. You look at the example of Iraq. You know, Saddam Hussein gave up his nuclear program, made him vulnerable to U.S. invasion. Likewise, Muammar Gaddafi in Libya gave up his nuclear program, made him vulnerable to NATO invasion. Ukraine gave up their nuclear program after the collapse of the Soviet Union, made them vulnerable to Russian invasion. Whereas, you know, North Korea, despite being one of the most repressive regimes on earth, has continued to stay around because they have a nuclear weapon. So it's easy to see how, you know, an Iranian Revolutionary Guard commander could argue for weaponizing their program. But I also think that the Iranians are probably mindful of the fact that their program has been pretty heavily penetrated by U.S. intelligence, by Israeli intelligence, and there's been remarkable amount of sabotage operations, whether that's, you know, explosions happening in Iran's nuclear facilities or the assassination of top Iranian nuclear scientists. So I don't think it's as simple as Iran simply making that decision that they're going to weaponize and getting easily from point A to point B. I think if they do decide one day, if a future Iranian leader decides they do want to pursue nuclear weapons, you know, I don't think it's going to be easy, and it could well trigger either a U.S. or Israeli military attack.
Kareem, I want to shift to the U.S. side of things, right? You said earlier that the Iranians believed that we are desperate for a deal. And I'm wondering if it's your assessment that that is the case. And I ask that because, you know, this isn't the greatest deal on the planet. This deal is not as good as the 2015 deal. The politics aren't great here for the president. He's got 14 senators in his own party that are opposed to the deal. He's got Iranian attempts to assassinate a former senior Trump administration official in retaliation for the U.S. killing of Qasem Soleimani, the head of the IRGC Quds Force. So this is not there's not a lot of positive things here. So are the Iranians right when they think we're desperate for this deal?
Michael, I wouldn't use the word desperate. I would use the word committed. There's a perception in Tehran that the United States is absolutely committed to reviving the JCPOA. And I think that is so far proven to be an accurate assessment. We've continued to say that there's no good alternative to reviving the deal. We have been reluctant to articulate any plan B. And, you know, every month we've said to the Iranians that time is running out, this is the last chance. But, you know, when you say that for a year and a half, the Iranians, you know, perhaps don't take it to heart because they feel like, as I said, that the JCPOA is always on the table for them and they can just, you know, continue to try to hold out for more concessions and hope that we will cave. But you are right that the political context in 2022, I said the geopolitical context is different now than it was in 2015 when the nuclear deal was signed. And also the domestic political context is different. And one of the things that's different now compared to 2015 is that the Biden administration has zero illusions that a nuclear deal with Iran may strengthen moderate forces in Tehran or may help lead to a U.S.-Iran rapprochement. In 2015, the Obama administration did have hopes that this could bring about a different U.S.-Iran relationship, almost, you know, perhaps lead to a Nixon to China type rapprochement. Secretary Kerry, I think, held out hope for that. And I think to some extent, President Obama did as well. And I don't think that there's any illusions now that the Biden administration has. And as you mentioned, I think for the president, he realizes that this deal is probably going to be, if the deal is revived, the impact is probably net negative for him in a domestic political context, meaning every single Republican, with the exception of Rand Paul, will probably oppose the deal's revival, and some key Democratic allies like Senator Robert Menendez, Chuck Schumer, who, you know, both voted against the deal in 2015, are not enthusiastic about it this time. So you never win points in the context of domestic American politics by appearing to ease pressure against a regime whose official slogan is Death to America.
We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor, then we'll be right back with more of our discussion with Kareem.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
So, Kareem, I want to come back to this point about the Iranians trying to get revenge, right, for the death of Qasem Soleimani. You know, it's absolutely clear that they have their eyes on former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, former National Security Advisor John Bolton, and some others. The Iranians are clearly able to separate the nuclear deal from getting that revenge. You know, how do you think we should think about that?
I know it's a major concern right now for the Biden administration how to deter Iranian plots to assassinate former Trump administration officials like Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, former National Security Advisor John Bolton. There's been ongoing plots to assassinate Iranian human rights activists in the United States. A close friend of mine, Masih Alinejad, she's one of Iran's top women's rights activists. There's been attempts on her life. She lives in Brooklyn, New York. And, you know, I'm told that so far, U.S. attempts to privately relay to Iran that there will be a major penalty for this has not deterred Iran, and that these plots are ongoing. And I think, you know, in the event that Iran succeeds in either killing a former senior U.S. official or killing an Iranian-American civil rights activist on U.S. soil, this is going to probably trigger a major debate in the Biden administration. How do you react to that? You have to do something. If you simply sit on your hands and don't react, Iran will probably feel like they can do it again. They feel emboldened that, you know, they can act with impunity. And, you know, we've witnessed this with Vladimir Putin over the last decade, that, you know, he waltzed into Georgia, into Crimea, into Syria without penalty. And, you know, that led him to think that he could attack Ukraine with impunity. And, you know, Iran has done this in the regional context as well, right? They feel they've prevailed in Syria and Iraq and Lebanon and Yemen. So at the moment, you know, both regionally and vis-a-vis, you know, adversaries in terms of these plots to avenge the life of Qasem Soleimani, there's a danger that Iran feels like it can act with impunity. And so obviously we want to do everything in our power to deter them. So far that hasn't worked. And so the question is, if indeed they succeed, you know, how do we react? There's not a whole lot of precedent for that.
So Kareem, I'm not ask a question about kind of the bigger context here and Iran's malign behavior in the region. You know, it was my sense in 2015 that once the Obama administration signed the deal, that they sort of closed the Iran file. They felt they were done with Iran rather than pushing back against what the Iranians were doing in the region, which our allies wanted us to do. And I actually remember the president giving a speech where he was defending the Iran deal by saying, look, we made arms control agreements with the Soviet Union throughout the Cold War. And we did it because we were, you know, that was in our interests. And what struck me was, you know, that's absolutely true. But at the same time, we were making arms control agreements, we were pushing back against Soviet aggression, you know, all over the world. And so I'm wondering if the Biden administration really understands that if they make a nuclear deal, there is still an Iran issue to be dealt with.
It's a great question, Michael, and I recommend to people the great work of the Yale historian John Gaddis about America's Cold War strategy. In his book, Strategies of Containment, he talks about the three-pronged approach that worked vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. You know, as you mentioned, you know, arms control is one element of it. Countering their external ambitions is another element. And there's a third element, which is also trying to support the forces of change. In the case of Ronald Reagan, it was within Russia. And in the case of Iran, obviously, it's supporting those inside Iran who want to see a different form of government. And so that's why, even though the Obama administration said this is only a non-proliferation agreement, the reality is that you have to have a broader strategy, because what ends up happening is that in the context of doing a non-proliferation deal with Iran, you unencumber them financially. So you know, giving them a major cash injection, you know, perhaps tens, if not even hundreds of billions of dollars, if they're able to sell their oil freely on the open market. And, you know, some of that money obviously goes to Iran's regional proxies, whether that's, you know, Houthis in Yemen, Shia militias in Iraq, Lebanese Hezbollah, Bashar Assad. And if you talk to U.S. partners in the Middle East, whether it's Israel or Gulf countries, what they'll tell you is that they're less worried about being nuked by Iran, and they're more worried about the drones, the missiles, the increasing precision rockets, which Iran and its proxies are using on a daily basis. And so, yes, it's not something which we can, if we're able to revive the nuclear deal, that's not the finish line. You know, it needs to be embedded in a broader strategy vis-a-vis Iran. I think that, like any administration, there are different views within it. You know, there's some who believe that the Middle East and Iran are not really a priority, and the only priority is to revive the nuclear deal, and then, you know, the focus needs to be on Russia and China. But, you know, as you know better than myself, you don't have the luxury of just, you know, focusing on one or two regions when you're the U.S. government. And the worldview of the Iranian government is not going to change. It's been consistent for 43 years. I would argue they've had a more consistent and enduring grand strategy than any government in the world over the last four decades. And you know, one of those strategies is to help bring down the U.S.-led world order. You know, they're willing to partner with anyone, whether that's China, Russia, Venezuela, North Korea, in order to do that. We've seen Iran openly side with Russia and after its invasion of Ukraine. And so, you know, much as we would like to de-escalate with Iran and not have an adversarial relationship with Iran, you know, you can't make amends with a regime which needs you as an adversary for its own internal legitimacy.
We're going to take another quick break. We'll be right back with more Intelligence Matters. Stay with us.
We all have busy lives these days, and we don't want to waste a day recovering after a night out. That's why ZBiotics is the answer we've all been looking for. Their probiotic was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. This is a proactive solution that wards off feeling miserable the next day instead of a reactive approach like drinking electrolytes or eating greasy food. Enhance your mornings with ZBiotics. Go to ZBiotics.com/CBS to get 15% off your first order when you use code CBS at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. No questions asked. Remember to head to ZBiotics.com/CBS and use the code CBS at checkout for 15% off. Thank you, ZBiotics, for sponsoring this episode and our good times.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
So, Karim, you mentioned our allies and partners in the Middle East. Is there a uniformity of views there about the deal, or are there some important differences?
Well, I think there's a difference between our Middle East partners and our European partners. I think there's virtual unanimity among the Europeans that a revival of the nuclear deal is in their national security interests, and the Europeans believe it's in the interests of stability in the Middle East. Although, you know, there's differences among some of the partners in terms of, you know, how you best reach a deal. Now, when it comes to our regional partners, you know, here we're talking about Israel and then Gulf countries like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar. I would say that the Israelis are much more sensitive about the nuclear file in particular. You know, Iran is something like 20 times larger than Israel, and given the Israel is a nation born out of the Holocaust, so they fear that you can't take a chance with an adversary that believes your existence is illegitimate. There's no margin of error. You can't allow an adversary that believes that to acquire a nuclear weapon. Whereas I think the Gulf countries are less focused on Iran's nuclear ambitions and much more focused on the proxies and again the precision rockets, missiles, and drones which Iran's proxies have been using to target civilian outposts in the UAE and Saudi Arabia and in Iraq as well.
Does Israel have a plan B? I mean, if it's arguing against the deal, what would their plan B be?
You know, when I testified before the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee a couple months ago, and in preparation for that, I really tried to talk to a lot of people from, you know, the left and right end of the spectrum about, you know, what is a prudent strategy? What are alternative strategies that I may be missing? And, you know, I found that there are no, this is a frustrating policy issue because, you know, like many issues, there's no silver bullet. There's no solution. It's a challenge which you have to manage. I mean, the Israelis and folks on the right in the United States would say it just requires more pressure. You need another maximum pressure campaign to either force the Iranian government to capitulate or implode. You know, those on the left end of the spectrum would say, no, you just have to be, you know, more solicitous towards them, take a softer approach, offer more incentives. But really, neither approach has worked. The only thing that's really worked over the last four decades is actually the combination of the two, which is, you know, significant multilateral pressure coupled with very rigorous diplomacy. And, you know, I think that, you know, part of the challenge here, Michael, is that denouncing a nuclear deal with Iran, it makes for good politics in both Israel and the United States for understandable reasons, because, you know, Iran's leadership oftentimes behave like, you know, Disney cartoon characters, you know, caricatures of villains, like the things that they say, Holocaust denial, death to America, you know, the repression of women, of ethnic minorities, religious minorities. Like, it's a tough argument, it's a tough political argument to say we should be easing pressure on Iran and lifting sanctions against them. It's a much easier political argument to say we should be tougher on this regime whose, you know, identity is premised on death to Israel and death to America. But this is where you see differences between the politicians and the security establishments who say, you know what, as much as, you know, we are concerned about lifting sanctions against Iran. And yes, this deal has its shortcomings, but, you know, what is the viable alternative? I haven't really seen any viable alternative that you can hang your hat on to a diplomatic agreement with Iran. Now, I'm not trying to argue that I think the way the Biden administration has pursued this revival of this deal has been flawless. My critiques of it, like many others, but I think there's no good alternative to a diplomatic agreement with Iran that, you know, hopefully buys us some time.
So, Karim, what happens, do you think, if there's a breakdown in the talks and there is no deal? What's your guess?
Well, it's interesting because I think that both the United States and Iran have an interest in making it appear that they're not going to walk away from the negotiating table. Iran, again, unless Iran's end state, its end game changes, and they actually have made the decision to make a mad dash for a nuclear weapon, it really behooves Iran to revive this agreement because they can't reverse their economic decline absent removal of sanctions. And this agreement is much more favorable to them than it was in 2015 because all of the sunset clauses are going to be soon expiring. So it makes eminent sense for Iran, if their goal is still to have a nuclear weapons capability, to revive this deal and get the sanctions relief. And then in a few years, you know, many of these sunset clauses will be lifted and they will be able to, you know, have that nuclear weapons capability. But I think that at the moment, the Iranians feel like they can continue to get more. From the United States vantage point as well, I think if you're President Biden and, you know, the goal is to shift away from the Middle East, certainly to not start another conflict in the Middle East and to keep, you know, the price of oil low, you don't want to escalate vis-a-vis Iran. So even if it appears there's an impasse, you don't want to walk away from the negotiations because, you know, you want to try to avoid an escalation. And, you know, I think one, to the extent there is any benefit and commitment to diplomacy is that we've very much proven to, I think in the court of international public opinion, it's clear to many that the obstacle here is not the United States, it's the obstacle here is Tehran. And that, you know, should win you a little more goodwill when it comes to enforcing sanctions against Iran. But as I said, I think we probably could be doing a better job of enforcing those sanctions.
So it sounds like your guess is that once we get beyond the midterms that and do some more negotiating, that there will be a deal at the end of the day here. Sounds like you think that.
This is such a pendulum, Michael, that, you know, the people who watch this, you go from, you know, optimism and the deal is imminent to, you know, extreme pessimism and it's never going to happen. And my view from the beginning is that it makes sense for both. I mean, as I said, the Biden administration has shown their commitment to reviving it. And for Iran, it makes a lot of sense to do this. As I said, they don't have a sense of urgency at the moment because they probably are thinking that they can continue to get more out of it. But yeah, I would say that as long as this current supreme leader is in power and Iran's endgame hasn't shifted, meaning they haven't made the decision to pursue the North Korea route and weaponize, they're still in pursuit of the Japan route, that it makes eminent sense for them to revive. So I would argue that it's more likely than not at some point the deal is revived, although I'm not arguing that it's imminent. And I think it will require a change of U.S. strategy or change of U.S. tactics to get the deal revived.
And Karim, one more question. Does the outcome of the war in Ukraine affect Iranian behavior in any way, do you think? Does it matter?
So the outcome of the Ukraine war is important in several ways. Number one, I think if Russia prevails, it simply further emboldens Iran and their belief that the U.S.-led world order is coming down and you know, further emboldens Iran to be defiant and partner with Russia and China and, you know, all other countries that don't like a U.S.-led world order. You know, second, the geoeconomics of it are complicated because a Russia which is faced with international isolation starts to compete with Iran in global oil and gas markets, in particular oil sales to China. And so Russia has eaten into Iran's oil exports to China because they've offered discounted oil to China, which is, you know, Iran's main source of exports. And so I actually think that although Russia and China are often lumped together when it comes to their views on Iran, I would argue Russia and China have diametrically opposed interests vis-a-vis Iran, and that China benefits from a nuclear deal with Iran and Iran, which is able to produce and export much more oil. That's, you know, very much in Beijing's interest. Whereas I would argue that's inimical to Russia's interests. They don't want to see an Iran that's emerged from international isolation, and they like the idea of Iran continuing to remain a thorn in the side of the United States.
Karim, thank you so much for joining us.
It's always my pleasure, Michael.
Great to have you. That was Karim Sajapour. I'm Michael Morrell. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
Intelligence Matters is sponsored by Palantir Technologies, foundational software of tomorrow, delivered today. The show is produced by Olivia Gassis, Jamie Benson, Paulina Smolinski, and Reggie Bazile. For more from this week's show, visit cbsnews.com. Intelligence Matters is a production of CBS News.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, wherever you get your podcasts starting May 8th. Access episodes early and ad-free with 48 Hours Plus on Apple Podcasts starting May 1st.